Jack Black again on our occasional series of podcasts. I'm really excited today because I've got my good friend Ed Pippett. Many of you will have come across Ed before if you've looked at the website and you see the videos. He's the tall, handsome guy who interviews me. And also if you've listened to some of the previous products we had out there, Ed and I very often had a chat in the studio, all very wonderful. And maybe many of you like me have got kind of really seduced by his wonderful voice. It's very, very special. Ed and I go back a long, long way. We're very good friends. He's also someone that truly inspires me. And we've got a business relationship, so it's all pretty perfect. So, Ed, welcome to the podcast. Really excited to speak to you about stuff today.
Thank you so much. And I have to say, I'm as seduced by your voice as you clearly are by mine. So it's a very mutual thing.
That's good. Excellent. Ed, maybe you could do as we're doing. Most people who will be listening to this, certainly in the beginning, will be Mindstore members, people who have attended courses. So I like to begin by asking people about their Mindstore credentials. Would you like to say something about that, how you got involved with us, how you first came across us, and so on?
Yeah, of course. It's a great story, actually, about 12 or 13 years ago now, I joined a seminar program with a company where we all hired a large minibus and drove from town to town, teaching mainly educational suppliers how to market and promote to schools and colleges. And we were in this minibus for a week, about 8 or 9 of us together. And the first stop was the Scratchwood services, I think, on the M11. The service is on the M11. Yep. And the driver said to me, listen, I've worked out we're going to be in this van together for something like 60 hours over the next 10 days. If anybody wants to buy a cassette or a CD to listen to on the journey, more than welcome. So two of us went in, and my friend Richard chose Billy Connolly Live at the Albert Hall.
Good choice.
And I found Jack Black, the ultimate mental fitness program.
Wow.
And I thought, I'm absolutely up for this. If I'm going to be sitting in a van with a pile of strangers for a week, I could really devote this time to some personal development.
Right.
Anyway, the exactly as expected, I guess, 8 days later, we must have listened to the Billy Connolly at the Albert Hall 25 times. Mindstore, the ultimate mental fitness program, was still in its wrapper. I hadn't actually persuaded anybody that this was the thing to listen to when competing against classic comedy, if you like. So at the end of the journey, the driver said, do you want to take this with you? And I thought, this is fantastic. So took it home, listened to it, and was utterly mesmerized. Wow. Utterly mesmerized. And I just loved the metaphor, the analogy of building this wonderful place in your mind, and then using it on a daily basis in personal development terms. So the first thing I did was get onto Amazon and buy the book. Having read the book, I went on to the Mindstore website to see that you were running regular public programs, and was hugely disappointed that the only one that year was in Dublin, and it was in about a week later, and I just thought, oh well, another time. And it was my wife who just sowed a little seed in me by saying, I bet you could fly to Dublin for 15 quid. And of course I looked up the flights. I got a flight for 15 quid. I managed to book the hotel that you were speaking in for 2 nights for something like 30 euros. I hired a car. I didn't even need it, but I hired a car for 2 days for 29 euros. Anyway, the long story short is that I found myself at your live event with a total outlay of about £75 plus the cost of the ticket, of course, and the rest is history. I've lived and breathed Mindstore ever since.
Fantastic, Ed. Right, great story, and I'm so glad you turned up because we've become great friends.
It's been magic. It's been a wonderful decade.
Yeah, fantastic. So one of the reasons why I want to speak to you today and share with you, because you've got a great gift that can help a lot of the listeners. But before we get there, do you mind if I just mention one or two things about you that really, really inspires me?
How could I say no to that, Jack?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, you've got a relatively sort of a geeky type interest in lighthouses. And what's interesting is I've got the island course, which I'm going to be presenting as a one-off in Glasgow, is in a venue called the Lighthouse.
I've noticed.
And, you know, it occurred to me the coincidence, and I was actually looking at the venue this morning in terms of our organisation, how we're going to lay out the room and stuff, because it's quite a quirky room, but it's really quite exciting to work there. And I thought maybe we should talk about it, because you have a passion for lighthouses, which led to something monumental. Do you want to say something a wee bit about, the lighthouse thing, how that came about, but ultimately share with the guys what you actually were able to do? Because obviously people who are into Mindstore get into the notion of setting big goals, but yours is just awesome.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Actually, it was only a few weeks ago that I dug out the very first Mindstore book that I completed, my night book, and I found my goal, which was to do the thing that I'm about to describe, which is from being very young, probably five or six, we used to spend every family holiday staying with my granny, who lived down on the south coast, very near to where I live now. And it was a very old house, and my middle brother and I shared a twin room right at the in the sort of eaves of the house. Yep. on the top floor, with a little tiny mullioned window, which, I mean, the house was a mile and a half from the sea, but one could have seen the sea from the windows. And every night, as I lay in bed, the local lighthouse at Dungeness would just flicker and flash and hit my bedroom wall. Wow. And I just found that magical. And for a while, I couldn't persuade my parents that that's what it was. They said, no, it's some car driving past, or, you know, it's somebody switching their bedroom light on or in the house opposite. And I absolutely rigidly counted that this flash came every 10 seconds all through the night, night and day. Wow. And funnily enough, if it had been the bedroom window opposite, then every time it was foggy, they didn't turn their lights on in the bedroom opposite. So it was obviously the lighthouse.
Yeah.
And that instilled in me from that age just an obsession with lighthouses. And I started to learn about family holidays and travel around the country, not in terms of the landscape or the hotels we stayed in or the holiday cottages that my parents rented, but in terms of the local lighthouse. So you know, when we spent our holiday up in the North York Moors, I had to get to Scarborough to see these lights, and then we went off to Lancashire, and I was desperate to get up to St. Bees to see the lighthouse there, and that happened for every holiday. But as soon as I'd sort of combined a little bit of independence by being given a bike and age 10, 12, being allowed to disappear off on my bike for bike rides, I had this idea that actually what I was going to do one day was to cycle around the coast of this country and tick off, if you like, every light. But you probably know it more in terms of bagging Munros, Jack. but for me, it was cycling around the coast, visiting every lighthouse.
Wow!
And I achieved my goal in 2015. So I took 4 months off work, and I managed to get a wonderful company based down near Bristol to sponsor me with a bicycle, and off I set. And over 4 months, visited 207 lighthouses, cycled 3,600 miles. And got jolly fit in the process for the first time in my adult life.
Wow. And the reason why you did it, Ed, do you want to share some of that? Or is that too personal?
Yeah, I mean, no, it's not personal at all. I'd always wanted to do it, but life gets in the way, as it always does. And then not long after I first met you, I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. And I thought, well, bearing in mind that one of the symptoms was that my legs stopped working properly and all sorts of sort of physical things challenged me. Yeah. But I thought probably the time was up and that I wouldn't ever get to do this bike ride. And I was just incredibly fortunate that I have what's called relapsing and remitting multiple sclerosis, which means that at times my health is very good and at times less so. And 2015 just happened to coincide with a period of really good health. So it just occurred to me, I decided in January, okay, I could physically take the time off work. My health is good. Let's just go for it. And so I was very, very lucky to be able to have that opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, I think for listeners who are into Mindstone, into some of the subtleties of it, if you were to rewind back there when Ed starts to begin to talk about his MS thing, one of the things you'll pick up very, very clearly is just how he uses very, very positive language, which is so inspiring. And one of the things that I always thought about when you were on, I had planned, or I'd rather had the intention, it didn't work out, to come and join you.
Yes, I remember.
At one point, and maybe spend a week, or maybe even if I could, 2 weeks. I had the notion of I'd get a train somewhere with my bike, catch up with you, and then leave you somewhere near a train station and get back.
Yeah.
It didn't quite happen. But I suppose one of the challenges I had with it, and, you know, I'm obviously relatively fit, certainly don't have issues in terms of what you have, had to face rather in the past with this. But I was kind of, you know, with all my tools and techniques and positivity and getting rid of anxiety and all that type of thing and mastering fear, I still had a massive doubt about my ability to get up and down some of those hills. and having spent a bit of time that particular year driving around Devon and Cornwall, some of those hills in Cornwall up and down to get to those lighthouses, I kind of thought, no.
Well, I mean, it's funny you say that, Jack, because, you know, I think I should point out, I am not a cyclist. You know, I did not set out to do this as a cyclist. And indeed, I forget his name, but you have another Mindstore member who I see online on social media a lot, who absolutely is a cyclist. Yeah. And every Facebook post he posts is of the latest road race he's done. And he's a lovely guy, but he's a serious cyclist. I mean, he wears Lycra and everything.
Yes, yes.
You know, one of my vows was that I would never knowingly wear Lycra next to my skin as part of his expedition. And you mentioned the Devon and Cornish Hills. You know, I have to be honest and say one of the lowest points was pushing my bicycle for probably 2 and a bit hours.
Yeah.
up the hill out of Lynmouth. And it was hell on earth. It was yeah, ghastly.
Yeah.
But for every morning that was challenging, you'd then cycle 15 miles along a disused railway line or along a canal towpath, and it was like utopia. It was like heaven. It was fabulous.
Yeah, wonderful stuff. So Ed, one of the things that that you also excite me about you is that you've been involved in the publishing world.
Absolutely.
And one of the reasons I wanted to speak to you was that over the years, so many people on the courses, when we got to the bit where we would be doing 30 goals, narrowing down to 7, it was amazing how often many people got the notion they would just love to write a book. And many of them actually left the course and resolved to do that. And I've got lots of first editions of lots of people's books.
Very good.
Some of them, it was just for the sake of having it, having done it, not necessarily becoming famous or necessarily a successful author. One or two became extraordinarily successful authors, which is amazing. But why do you think people, given that you're into publishing, why do you think so many people in Mindstore, when they get the chance to consider their future, an alternative future, maybe what they're leading right now, thinking bigger, thinking far more creatively. Why do you think so many people would love to write a book?
So I think, Jack, it's because Mindstore appeals to a particularly creative, open-minded tier of people. Yep. And by definition, they are probably certainly readers and may well already be writers in some capacity. And I think, you know, they have a view of life. They are open-minded to life's challenges and problems and issues, and are probably minded to write themselves in any case.
Yeah, one of the things I've written a few books, not all published. I've published two, but one or two I held back. I'm glad I did, because they were not as good as they could have been, and they were in a different time and a different reason for people might have read them. But one of the great, I'm interested in what your view is in terms of helping people capture their ideas or some of the stuff you're aware of that might encourage people to get beyond just the notion of doing it, but actually begin somehow or other. I mean, one of the things I was very fortunate to read about was, well, first of all, I had a very interesting conversation with Tony Buzan.
Away
before I did the first, I wrote the first book, and I was working with him, and he very kindly said to me that, look, when you get to writing a book, there's a little editor character that sits on your shoulder, constantly editing, constantly saying it's not good enough, constantly saying you could improve that page, that paragraph, that chapter. And he said, look, sooner or later you've got to give in and just hand it over the way it is at a given moment. The other thing that I realised, I was driving up to Aberdeen one day, and I was listening to Radio 4 or something, and there was an interview with one of the writers of Coronation Street.
Ah, yes.
And he said something really inspiring. He said that, like, what he does is that he will get up and round about 10:30 in the morning, he would work for about an hour on the next part of his writing that was relevant for the script of
Coronation
Street. But he said that what he then did was he'd finish that round about, so he starts about 10:30, round about 12 he would stop. He would then have a long lunch. I would then have an afternoon sleep. And he said round about 3 o'clock, he would then return to his work that he'd done the previous day. And he would then edit that.
That's very interesting.
So he had a pipeline thing going on. But what he was saying was that overnight and over the 24 hours or so and more, his subconscious would be doing some kind of editing thing anyway.
Sure.
Of what he'd written the first time. And he always found that when he went back to it, it was much clearer what he had to do. And he found that constant editing had gone. I found that really inspiring, and I've used it ever since. But any tips you have yourself?
You've hit on two things straight away there. Looking at the Tony Buzan example, who, incidentally, is one of the most prolific authors. I mean, he's absolutely. But what he said is absolutely true. Most of us, but quite naturally, never get beyond the writing stage because either we believe what we've done isn't good enough, or we think people won't be interested in it, or, as you say, we just edit and re-edit and re-edit and re-edit and are never satisfied that it is good enough. Yeah. And so we've always got a reason why it's tomorrow's job getting it published rather than today's job getting it published.
Yeah.
And the first rule, the first tip, the Buzan example, kind of leads on to the Corey guy, which is that you absolutely have to write and walk away.
Yeah.
And you may well revisit what you have done, and you should do so. But once you've revisited it once, possibly twice, it is then the job of someone else, not you, to improve it further. Your job then is to keep moving on to the next unit, the next chapter, the next bit of the story, whatever it might be. And it's interesting. Often I will write a paragraph or sentence. I'll play around and tinker with it until I think it's quite good. And I can then, exactly as you've described, get up the next morning, look at it, and immediately think of, it may only be a tweak of one phrase or two words, but I have instantly improved it and thought, I can't believe I wrote it the way I had the previous evening.
Wow.
I'm sure you are right that it is your subconscious working away, and just naturally the following morning coming back with an improvement on what you have done.
Yeah. But it was interesting in the morning.
Tip number one, allow that time.
Yeah, but what was interesting was his method was that in the morning, when he knew he was slightly more creative, he could come up with the new stuff and leave it 24 hours to the next afternoon to do the final edit, as it was. The other thing I love what you said there is the thing that somebody else can then do the final edit, because, I mean, one of the things that's helped me is I going through school, I didn't do very well at English. The teacher said famously to my father, you'll never pass his higher English. I'm glad I did, but not necessarily with a great mark. And I always had a doubt about my writing, particularly around grammar, spelling. And anybody who follows me on Facebook, and sometimes people in LinkedIn, have got quite annoyed with me because I've kind of rushed through a post and there's glaring mistakes. But that didn't put me off the writing. And nowadays, of course, only just the other day I came across Grammarly. Which allows me to just double check again, even beyond what Apple offer, in terms of just correcting things, and it makes a big. So it gives you more confidence. But I think having somebody not to worry so much, because ultimately, if you're going to publish a book, you can get someone else to skim over it. But that's good.
And in fact, I'd go further than that. However good a writer you are, however natural a writer you are, there is a stage between finishing your manuscript and being happy with it yourself and getting it actually printed and published, which is that editorial stage. You will need an editor's work. I believe I write extremely competently, but I wouldn't be so arrogant or presumptuous to assume that is the finished product and it's ready to go. And so I'm always staggered by what an editor then does with my own writing, which is beyond measure an improvement. Yeah. That the challenge one has with an editor is finding someone to work with who understands your voice, but is nevertheless going to improve your words.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that too, because one of the pieces of advice that Tony Bazan offered me that sunny afternoon in his garden was that I should never ever get a ghostwriter. And so for my my second book, funnily enough, I was under pressure by the publisher to write one, but I was so busy at that point, building Mindstore, traveling all over, running staff, and it was just completely flat out, and they kept pestering me, well, why don't you do a, half an hour in the morning or something? And eventually I gave in, and I got someone else, a ghostwriter. And she came in. What was good about that was I had appointments. She would come and she would sit and, the recorder was on and I'd have to basically speak the book to her.
Yeah.
But it's funny, he was right. He said, you'll never feel it's like it's never your book. And I didn't ever feel that second book was mine.
Interesting.
So that's another thing for people. You know, it's like don't sort of opt out and get someone else to do it. It's much better if you do it yourself. So a couple of things that come to mind just that we're talking about this, because I really would love for more of the people to trust themselves to write, because so many have done it and they feel so good when they have. And then these days of self-publishing, do they still need an agent or a publisher, or can you do it without all that stuff?
Well, I think that's one of the tragic things at the moment, that actually if you Google publish my book or get my book published, you are presented with so many extremely strong personal opinions either for or against. And I actually believe there's a different publishing model for everyone. Everybody's writing is different.
Yeah.
Everybody's expected outcome is different. Some people want to write that million copy best-selling novel.
Yes.
Some people want to write about their inspiring grandparents.
Yep.
For a small book for their own family. Other people want to do some exhaustive research on a piece of history that will appeal to a few dozen people, but will be nevertheless a very important book academically. Now, there is absolutely a place for finding an agent and finding a publisher, and the sort of book or writer for whom that would be the right approach would be if you're writing a book that you know has mass appeal, but you don't know how to access any of those readers. So let's imagine you are quite an insular person, you love the project of writing, and you write semi-erotic, trashy novels. incredibly popular.
Yeah.
It is a huge genre. You know, there's an almost inexhaustible appetite for such books. But actually, what you're good at is sitting writing them. You don't know anybody who reads them. You certainly wouldn't know how to market and promote your book to that readership.
Yeah.
That would absolutely be a case where finding an agent and getting your book published by a mainstream publisher is still an absolutely valid and important route.
Yeah.
By contrast, if you are a dental practitioner and you've written a book for other dental practitioners, well, I could go and buy an email marketing list and a mailing list of every dental practitioner in the country. And so I am just as well off as any mainstream publisher at reaching the target audience for that book.
Yeah.
And so under those circumstances, I would say, no, don't waste your time looking for a publisher for this book, because you could do just as good a job yourself at both publishing the book and then marketing and promoting it. And so the short answer to your question is there is still very much a place for the agent and traditional publisher approach, but self-publishing absolutely appeals to a different authorship and readership.
Yeah.
And I would say the right approach to publishing depends entirely on both you as a writer, but also the specific book idea that you've got.
Yeah, and where you're aiming that and your expectations of what you might want to do with it.
Precisely.
And if someone wanted to publish their own book, is that an expensive process?
No, it needn't be. I mean, these days, again, you Google self-publishing and you'll have everything from attend this course and I'll show you how to sell and become an Amazon bestseller, right down to it costs nothing to self-publish. You just click here, click there, send your manuscript here, and bish bash bosh, next week it's selling on Amazon. The reality is that I believe you can publish a book in stages where you are building your reputation as an author, you're building your readership and your fan base and your loyalty, and you're not committing much money as you proceed. So what I tend to recommend to people is, if you have a manuscript ready that's been edited, that you're ready to go with, I would start by publishing it as an ebook, because you can publish a book as an ebook for either no money if you're reasonably competent with IT, or for a very small investment, £50-60, to get someone to turn your manuscript files into the right file formats. Yep. That the various ebook retailers need. And you could be published and selling, and most importantly, getting feedback and getting reader reviews and so on for your work before you then think, yeah, okay, people will like this book, people want this book, I'm now going to invest a bit more in it and make a paperback edition of the book, a physical copy of the book that I can sell at events, that I can sell through book clubs, that I might even get on Amazon, but I might even get into my local Waterstones. And I would build it up in stages rather than commit hundreds or thousands of pounds in printing thousands of books. A lot of the authors that I've worked with in the past have managed to invest a lot of money, get the unit cost of their paperback books down to a very modest sum, but have had to print thousands and thousands of copies of their book in order to do so. And they no longer have a garage in which they can park their car because they're full of boxes of books that they can't sell.
Yeah.
And so I believe the model is start slowly, start with an ebook, build some loyalty, and then progress as you can see sales and loyalty and readership and returns come in.
Nowadays, there seems to be an app for everything. Are there any sort of programs or appy type things that can help the budding author that you might think might be helpful?
Well, I mean, you came up with one, which is the Grammarly one.
Yep.
Certainly in terms of the writing, there are plenty of apps to help you. I personally find that I get on best if I can write using a completely blank screen. I don't want interruptions.
Yeah.
And I find even, say, Microsoft Word's screen, there are so many buttons everywhere that actually they distract me from my core job, which is actually putting words on the page.
Yeah.
And so there are many apps, whether it be for a tablet or a laptop or whatever, both Mac and PC, which are, they call them distraction-free word processors. And I've certainly used those in the past. There are plenty of apps for turning manuscripts into ebooks, but to be honest, it's not a difficult process. And the few that I've used actually seem to make the process of converting files more complicated rather than easier.
Okay.
And I think one thing I'd say to steer people in the right direction is that there are a lot of companies who try and make out that the process of getting published is more complicated than it in fact is. Yeah. And so will offer to do some of those publishing services on your behalf in return for both a fee and a percentage of your sales of your book.
Yeah.
And I think they're sort of a third tier of company that's standing between you and the retailer that actually isn't providing a service for which you would need to pay. So there's a little bit of a learning curve for sure, but actually turning a manuscript into an ebook, you shouldn't really be paying anybody a percentage of sales of your book for doing that, because it is a one-off, short, simple job. And so I would steer clear of, they call themselves self-publishing companies,
yes.
Where you know you send your manuscript off and you pay a fee, and in return you get a cover design, you get representation, you get distribution, you get this, you get that. Actually, if you look at each of the services they're providing, you could do that on your own, and you could do a better job, and you'd have more, because it's your work. You would care more about each stage of the process than the company that you've paid to do it for you.
Yeah. And just one of the things that I find, you know, I suppose it goes way back to the programming that went on very early on when I didn't get on with an English teacher, and I started to build lots of doubt and stuff, which I overcame by writing the book. And I've told the story often, I actually met her in an airport once, and I went up to her and I told her, by the way, do you remember who I am? And she didn't. And I said, well, here's what you told me. I said, by the way, I've published a best-selling book. And I kind of felt, you know, that sort of cheeky wee Glasgow guy telling her where to go. But she was good-natured about it, and I was, to be honest, too. And
I would have loved to have witnessed that, mate.
Yes, and it was rather pleasant to be able to send her a copy of it. But there you go. But one of the things I find is because of that type of thing that happened to me in my childhood, in my early years, when it came to typing to write, I found blockage, and I'm not a great typer. So one of the things that's helped me and may help others is I still like to handwrite everything.
Okay.
And okay. I handwrite everything first. Once it's written down. Nowadays, of course, you can just speak it into literally your laptop and it gets typed away for you. And that's been awesome. And that might encourage people as well, you know, in terms of they might think, oh, God,
I think there's a good point. We assume, don't we, that most people work the same way we work. No. And actually, for me, a distraction-free word processor where it's just a big white screen and I can see the words that I'm typing works for me. For another person... Yeah, no, absolutely. For another person, it's dictating in straight into a laptop and seeing your words come up on the page. Or indeed for you, it's actually getting a pen and a decent pen and a nice sheet of white paper and start writing. Whatever works, but the important thing is to keep going and to accept what you have done and not continually be self-critical of it.
Yeah.
Because what inevitably you need is momentum. If you're writing a book, you need momentum, because actually writing 40, 50, 60, 70, 80,000 words is a big job. It's not a morning's work. It's an hour a day.
Absolutely.
It's an hour a day for 12 months, or it's a morning a day for 6 months, whatever it might be. But it's a real commitment. And if you're stopping every other paragraph and thinking, no, I could do better than that. That's not good enough. That's not good enough. That's not good enough. You will never get that thing done.
I mean, going back to the Coronation Street guy, one of the things that I picked up again, just as you do, listening to something driving fast down the motorway, heading somewhere away back in those days, I came across an interview with Paula Yates. And she was also a fairly prolific writer, but she also had that breakfast TV program with ginger-haired guy, what's his name, doesn't come to me at the moment. But
Chris Evans.
Chris Evans,
and you're referring to the Big Breakfast.
A Big Breakfast, indeed. And what I found amazing was that she would be rising, you know, to get to the studio. She'd have to leave the house around about 5 a.m. And she said that what she did, she just had the discipline at 4:30 every morning to write for half an hour.
Very interesting. You see, whether
she had a book in mind or not, and that captured,
she would just write.
She just got that pattern in her life. And that really worked. Now, we're not asking people to do that or not even recommending it, but a lot of people could get into that type of discipline. The other thing that really excites me about why Mindstore people can do so well with this is that we have extra tools and techniques that the average writer just doesn't have. I mean, at least the guy in Coronation Street was aware of the subconscious. He was aware of handing it over to something, whether people believe in handing over to a superpower or a higher power, a higher them, a god, the fairies, or just their subconscious. There's something really powerful in that break before going back to that second edit or first edit 24 hours later. But the other thing is that because of Mindstore, we can also tap into creativity that others can't when we're in our alpha state.
Entirely. So, for example, tools to focus, for clarity, for creativity, for using your imagination, all those tools are absolutely essential for writers. And when you hear people talk about writer's block is when you're lacking access to those tools. And you can just program those using Mindstore tools and techniques.
It's awesome, man. And one of the really exciting things that I remember hearing away in the journey was before Harry Potter became really, really big, that the writer admitted that she was just relaxing one day and he came into her mind.
Isn't that wonderful?
He told her what to write.
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
Now, I've heard this a few times from authors that I've met and worked with, and indeed writers of, you know, people who are involved in the TV world or the film industry.
Sure.
And how in moments of just sleeping in the afternoon or sunbathing, even when they were on holiday, that the ideas came. And of course, we all know where they're coming from. They're coming from a right brain in that alpha state. And even those who, you know, waking up in the middle of the night, you know, famously the great musician Mozart, you know, the great, he would wake up in the middle of the night and the ideas were flowing and he would get up and write them down, you know, if thank God he did, because there must have been lots of them that he missed. But we are uniquely able to tap into that with our alpha state.
Totally, totally. And so, you know, you were talking earlier about Paula Yates and the discipline of writing for half an hour at 4:30 in the morning or whatever. I just know that my best, most imaginative and most creative writing comes before 11 o'clock in the morning. Any time I write after that, it could be better. But I tend to set my alarm early, get up, be at my desk and writing, so that I can move on and forget my writing once 11 o'clock's passed, because I know I won't be at my best.
Just fantastic to know that, isn't it?
It is fantastic to know that, and you know, you need to accept that. You know, sometimes you might think I want to write 10,000 words, but you know that if you've written I know that if I've written 2,000 words by 11 o'clock, even were I to force myself to write an additional 8,000 words, they would be pretty unusable 8,000 words. Yes. And I may as well get up the following morning and try and write 2,500 good words than write 8,000 words that aren't going to be of sufficient quality for what I'm doing.
And it's just amazing how the material builds up. One of the things I've been doing this past year, I resolved at the start of the year, when I do my goal setting thing, that I wanted to create an ebook of encouraging material. And one of the things I had been doing for a number of years was just posting on Facebook. And I decided this year to to trust what was coming through every month, because I go into the foundation state, you know, and I say, okay, what am I going to write about? And it just comes, and it's never let me down. Sometimes I'm not doing it every day because I'm just busy and I can't fit it in. But what I've been doing is I've been writing them, and we're now in October, more or less every day. And I know that when I go back at the end of the year, I've got all the material I need to do a kind of ebook. Just pulling all those different posts together, editing them a bit, you know, and so. Anyway.
And what you've hit there is just the regularity, the routine.
Exactly.
Because you might, even if you were to write 100 words a day, 100 words a day, and you might think, well, I'm never going to get anywhere. But that's 500 words a week.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
That's 2,000 words a month.
Yeah.
Well, in 2 years, okay, 2 years. But in two years, you've got 50,000 words there that are eminently publishable.
Yeah. Not only the discipline of doing it every day, which is relatively easy, but the bit that's really exciting from my point of view is that because I trust what happens in my alpha state, and speaking to my inner coaches, whatever we want to call them, or just trusting what comes through, I always find something to write about. It's like just amazing. Now, I wouldn't be able to do it to the same degree if I was just functioning with my good old left brain and my sort of arrogant left brain as we were thinking, oh, I can do this on my own. But that's what gives us the edge. And the other thing, of course, is not only using the alpha state to access the creativity and so on and to find the ideas, we've also got the ability to program finding the publisher, the conversation with the publisher.
Totally.
You know.
So I remember you telling me that your first publisher, publisher that you met, you shared a taxi with, or you shared a train journey with, and were introduced to HarperCollins.
Yes, it was, the whole HarperCollins thing came about because a guy, Jimmy Bell, famous in Airdrie in Scotland. Everybody in Airdrie knows him. He's just the giant, and Jimmy took a shine to, he came to Mindstore course, took a shine to it, took a shine to me, and, you know, invites me to his daughter's wedding. We go, and we're sharing a car between the church and the reception,
That's right.
Sharing it with his brother, who happens to be the CEO of HarperCollins. And, you know,
couldn't make it up, could you?
What do you do? And I said, well, what do you do? He was a publisher. I said, oh, funny, I've been sort of thinking about writing a book. He said, well, if you do, let me see it. And lo and behold, there it was, published. It was awesome. And not only that, I found myself my Fizzog, life-size Fizzog, as it were, on the side of London buses promoting the book.
The amount of publicity I got
was awesome, you know, and get into Watkins Books, you know, in the West End, and there's a life-size cutout of me on the sort of landing of the stairs as I went down to the personal development section. Pretty bizarre.
That doesn't happen very often, Jack.
It's the power of programming. But anyway, Ed, probably going on a little bit now, but anything else you'd like to share with
the fellow Mindstore
members?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've talked about the writing episode, but I think what I want people to take away is, you know, I've worked in the publishing sector for 27 years on both sides of the fence. I've been a mainstream publisher. I was publishing director at Let's Educational, those home study books to get kids through GCSEs and A-levels. But I've also worked with self-published authors for the last 10 years. And what I would say is that, you know, I would just want people to remember there is no single publishing route that is right or wrong.
Yeah.
And that every book is different. And I would just implore Mindstore members not to take at face value what an internet search tells them is the best route to publication.
Wow.
Because
wow.
There are an awful lot of people who just want to take some money from you to produce a book. And actually, so much of the process is something that either through friends, family, calling in a few favors, or a little bit of a learning curve with some technology, you can publish your work as an ebook yourself for very little outlay, prove that there is a readership, that, that this book is valuable. And at that point, you're in a much more powerful position, either to then go and find a mainstream publisher, or then to invest some more money in getting physical paperback books published and printed in order to meet the demand that you already know is there. And so I would implore Mindstorm members not to invest heavily, but to invest gradually in line with the demand that you can prove for yourself.
Yeah, fantastic. I mean, one of the things about you, Ed, that I love about you is, you know, apart from our friendship, because way back, and this, the way that you've helped Mindstorm in all sorts of ways, including those interviews and so on, both audio and on video, it's the fact that you're such an integrous guy. And you're a massively caring person. And I think that one of the things that would just be awesome is, I know that Mindstorm people would, and if they have met you, they'll be the same as me, they just instantly like you, is that they could trust you. And I think that maybe one of the things maybe you might consider is creating some sort of course or something that would take people from the starting point to the finish. And I know if you did such a thing, Mindstorm folks would be in safe hands and would find their way from their ideas to get published, because, you know, it's just needing that right type of help. And so many, without that level of help, have been massively successful in writing their books.
Well, it's funny you should say that. I mean, you're not the first person to say that I should put a course together. I have in the past, as you know, done sort of one day events in theatres. Getting people into theatres to learn how to publish their books, and I'm not planning to do many more of those. But funnily enough, I have been thinking very recently about how to put that same content into some sort of online course that people could study, so that they don't make the mistakes that so many people do. So watch this space is the answer.
Well, that's wonderful. I hope you do that, Ed. I know you're very busy, but it would be amazing if you did that. And when you do, I'll certainly let all the Mindstorm folks who keep in touch with me know about that.
Well, that's very kind. Thank you.
So, Ed, thanks for all your time. Really appreciate it. I know you're busy.
Pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
And for the listeners, I mean, honestly, I so many have done it, and I've got so many of those first editions and a nice little message and an autograph. It would be amazing if you're listening today, you think, that's it, I'm now going to do it. And I would urge you to do it, because it's really wonderful.
I concur. I entirely agree. Just go for it.
Yeah. Cheers, Ed. Well, you know, it only works. So if we use our mind store as well as our natural abilities, then who knows? Anyway, Ed, as ever, onwards and upwards. Wish you every success with all the things you're doing, and looking forward to catching up with you again soon.
And the same back again in spades.
Cheers, Ed. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. Bye-bye. Take care.